This is the G.I. Jive, man alive. It starts with...
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are continuing here at the Heinz History Center, home to the exhibit We Can Do It, World War II. It will be here for the rest of 2015, and we're dedicating our show to stories about this exhibit and about those featured in the exhibit. And in this next segment, we're going to talk with some men who served in the European and Pacific theaters during World War II, and I'm joined now by Walter Patton, who was in the Army Air Corps in the European Theater during World War II, and he joins me here at the Heinz History Center. Walter Patton, it's a pleasure meeting you. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
My pleasure.
Where were you on December 7th, 1941? Do you remember?
1941, I was a senior in McKeesport High School, and I was in bed when I heard the radio blaring, announcing that Pearl Harbor was being attacked by Japanese forces. Woke me up when I came downstairs, and that's it. No television in those days, so I got the report of what was happening on the radio.
So as you're hearing about this attack, are you putting together the idea that, you know, I may end up getting involved in this?
No doubt about that. I knew I was going to get involved. I had an older brother that was already involved. He and his friend had enlisted in the Air Corps, and they were already serving. So it was just a matter of time till I reached my 18th birthday that I would have to sign up for what we called the draft in those days, and I would be drafted into the military.
So you knew that you were going to end up serving, but you weren't sure exactly which branch of the service it would be, and there was one particular branch that you wanted to avoid. It was something that your mother wanted you to do. Explain this request that she had.
My older brother, his name was Bill. He had enlisted with a friend of his into the Air Corps, and they were trained as airplane mechanics. And shortly after I reached my 18th birthday, that was in September, in October, this brother of mine was on a training flight and was part of a crew on a B-17 plane that crashed in the mountains of New Mexico, and all on board were killed, including my brother, Bill. And after that, my grieving mother took me aside, knew that I was age to be drafted. She made me promise that I would not enlist in the Air Corps the way my brother did. So what am I going to do? With my grieving mother, I said, yeah, I won't do that, Mom. I won't enlist.
So you tried to go to the Navy, right? But that didn't work out.
Well, what happened is when you waited to be drafted, the authoritarians placed you wherever they wanted to place you. But I waited to be drafted, too, because at that time you could. If you passed all the necessary requirements, you could request the branch of service you wanted. So what happened is I did report when I was ordered, and I passed all the requirements, and I asked to be placed in the Navy, but they turned me down because I was classified what they called special services. I didn't know what that was, so I waited. All I was told was, you can't be in the Navy because you're already in the Army. So they placed me in the Army. Special services meant that they were going to send me to school to train me to be a certain thing, and it was going to be in the United States Army Air Corps. And I had promised my mother I would not volunteer for the Air Corps, but Uncle Sam outdid my mother and placed me in the Air Corps.
So what was it like? How did you break the news to your mother?
It was a very difficult letter for me to write from the basic training base, which at the time was Atlantic City, New Jersey, informing my mother that I was in the Air Corps. I didn't know what that meant, what was going to happen, anything, but it was a very difficult time for me to write the letter informing my mother of that.
Walter, where were you when the war ended?
I was in the country of France when Nazi Germany surrendered. So I was a part of the big celebration in the country of France. I was jogging around with the French people during the time of the war in Europe ended. About 7 or 8 days later, I was then boarded on a troop ship and sailed across the Atlantic Ocean, and I was on the island of Trinidad on August 15th, whenever Japan surrendered, ending the war. That's where I was at, on the island of Trinidad. But it turned out to be okay because I'm still here.
Here you are. That's a great story. Walter Patton, so nice to meet you. Thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
You're welcome.
I'm now with Edward Huzar, who is from the Pittsburgh area and served in the U.S. Army Air Corps during World War II, was in the Pacific Theater for the duration, basically. He was drafted into the U.S. Army in October of 1941. So that was before Pearl Harbor, before the United States was involved in World War II. And Edward Huzar, you're here with your son, Carl. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
Ed, tell me how you ended up being drafted before America's involvement in the war.
At that time, they had come out with that draft. And they says that you get a certain number. And so I get this notice that the U.S. Army's calling you. That's now before the war. And I went to Harrisburg with the whole group of guys. I don't know how many guys returned that went with me. And most of us went to the Pacific, and they went to different outfits. I sort of ended up as a medic. I had a portable hospital, and a portable laboratory, more or less, because I worked in a lab. And what they did in Kellogg was they would put 4 to 6 guys together and send you overseas as a unit. And how much experience we had wasn't very much.
You were doing the island-to-island thing in the Pacific Theater, fighting with our soldiers, and you ended up in Okinawa toward the end of the war. Tell me about what the fighting was like there.
On Okinawa, well, it was mostly bombing that we were in. Planes used to come over every night. In fact, this one particular day, we had landed on New Guinea. That night, we put the radio on. Tokyo Rose comes on. Tokyo Rose says, 7th Air Service Group, we know where you're at. We're coming in tonight to bomb you. That's our outfit.
So you're on Okinawa in 1945, yeah, toward the end of the war, and describe what that was like in the days leading up to when the bomb was dropped.
We were on the island and preparing for the invasion of Japan. In fact, I had my truck loaded, and we would go down to the motor pool and see what else we were going to take. We had no direct writing that we was going to invade Japan, only from word of mouth that we're going to invade Japan. Well, it happened to be we was on Okinawa, when the bomb was dropped, and that was as close as you could possibly get to the bomb. That night, when the bomb was dropped, we was all scared because nobody had gas masks. So they started to call the United States, see if they could send the gas masks over and fast.
Also with us is your son, Carl, who has heard a lifetime of stories from you serving in World War II. And Carl, it must be amazing to have a father who can recall stories like this that are such an important part of history and an integral part of World War II history, particularly America's participation in the Pacific Theater.
Absolutely. We're very proud. I have 2 sisters, myself, and we've heard a lifetime of stories from our father, and we like to think that he's representative of the best that the World War II generation had to offer. He's given us great inspiration, and he's used these stories a lot over our lifetime to teach us lessons and give us inspiration as to how we should conduct our lives. He was very proud that the American soldiers in his unit, whenever they were on that battlefield, conducted themselves in a very professional manner. I think is almost a mantra for how he's conducted his life, always trying to do the right thing and do the correct thing for all people.
Edward Huszar, Carl Huszar, thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much for having us down.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having us.
And now I'm joined by George Herwig, who was in the Coast Guard during World War II in the Pacific Theater and covered a lot of territory, which I'll let him explain. First of all, George Herwig, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Good morning. Good afternoon. George Herwig, United States Coast Guard representative. Usually I do Coast Guard because there's not too many Coast Guard left, so they usually use me around the city as the last of the Coast Guards. But I spent about 3 years in the Pacific. I was in the service from 1942, January 42, till November of 1946. So that was my stint. I was young then. And when you're young and have never done anything like that before, I went down to the post office building, and the first floor was all Marines and Navy, and I didn't want to stand in line, so I went up the second floor, and it was mostly Navy, and I looked up in the third floor of the old post office building right next to where Kaufman's department store was at one time. But I looked up there, and there was only a few guys standing there, and I said, "What's that up there?" And the guy says, "Ah, you don't want to be up there. That's the hooligan Navy. That's the Coast Guard." I said, "That's where I belong, with the hooligans." So I joined them up on the third floor, and I said, "What do you guys do?" And he said, "Well, we guard the coast." They just didn't tell me what coast I was going to be guarding. I was pretty much shipped all over the country doing different things. I spent four months, actually in the Atlantic. I had wanted a destroyer in the worst way, and the officer that was in charge of my group here on Long Island, where I'd first gone, I told him, I said, "I want a destroyer." And every week I came in there, I got to drive a bus from Long Island into New York City, back and forth six times between there and Long Island, hauling Navy people, Army people, mostly officers, back and forth. And I kept telling my commanding officer, he was actually from Pittsburgh, his name was Dick Seville, I kept bugging him about a destroyer. So one day I come in and he said, "George, I've got your destroyer for you." And so they put me on my own bus into New York City, and I went to Norfolk. And the next day, young lady had us in a truck, and we're passing these beautiful cruisers and these beautiful destroyers. And I'm thinking, there, I've got my destroyer finally. And we went past all this stuff, and there was this line of old World War I four stackers, and she says, "That's your destroyer." And my heart just dropped down. I thought, oh, an old destroyer. But it was a four stacker, and it had been converted from coal to oil. And I was on that for about 3 months, convoy duty. Had two trips to Murmansk, Russia, and then we went into Casablanca. And we were supposed to back up the group that were chasing Rommel out of Africa, but we were too late for that. So now when I tell people I was in Africa in those times, they said, "Well, what was our port there was Casablanca." And when I first went and said, "Well, we're going to Africa," I'm thinking lions, tigers, elephants, giraffes, and so on. And I'm thrilled that we're going. And there, Casablanca's a big city. So people say to me now, and I tell them, I said, "Well, I was in Casablanca, but I didn't get to Rick's place."
You just passed me a list of all of the different islands that you have been to. And this is quite a list. I mean, we'd have to spend several minutes going over all of it. One of the things that jumps out at me is Tarawa. Tell me about that. That was a place that was a lot of devastating things happened there.
I was really bombed out when I got there, and we didn't drop ammunition there. We dropped mostly food for the Army and the Marines, because they were hard pressed for any kind of food there. They were eating out of canned foods, and I don't know if you ever had the canned foods that were preserved for the military overseas. good fresh food, in even in cans, was tastes good for them. Just give them a great big can of peaches, and those guys that just almost come up and kiss you for it. The trees were all bombed out. The land was almost wasted by the time we got there. And we brought several people out to put them on ships, on destroyers, to take them, I guess, to Australia for the services that they'd put in, because a lot of them were in really bad condition and had to be taken to, a lot of them never made it to any place to be be rebuilt, so to speak. So a lot of them lost their legs and limbs. I was fortunate on our ship. We had a couple. We had some guys that were killed. You'll have to excuse me. It's
something that's even to this day, 70 years later, it still chokes you up.
It's a terrible thing to bury people at sea, and I even when I refer to it, even 70 years later, it still grabs me. So, but almost all the islands looked the same landing. When we went in, we dropped ammunition for the Army mostly, and the Marines, and we dropped mostly 105 howitzer, 20 millimeter, 40 millimeter, and sometimes 50 caliber. I was on a 50 caliber gun on my ship, and when we left San Diego, our skipper, he told us if we encounter our aircraft, he said, "You're shooting down a machine. Don't think of it any other way. You're shooting down a machine." And that's what we primarily did when we encountered some aircraft. And my buddy and I cut a Japanese bomber in half, and we were shooting down a machine. So that's the way you kind of had to feel about it.
You would have to think of it that way. Otherwise, it would probably be just too overwhelming.
Yeah, absolutely. But it was a long war, but I was young, and we were in the Pacific for the better part of 3 years. And I didn't realize a whole lot of this, and I never talked much about it to my parents or when I even got married. My kids have grown up, and they knew I was in the service. They knew what service I was in, but nothing was ever pressed to me. About 5 years ago, 6 years ago, a young man by the name of Dan Cavanaugh took a whole bunch of servicemen to Washington, D.C., down to see the National Memorial for World War II. And that was very impressive. And on the way back, he decided that we would start a group telling of our experiences overseas. And there were 25 of us that got together with this, and I named the group the Veterans Breakfast Club. And from that 25, we've grown into about 155. And we now meet once a month at different places, mostly at Salvatore's restaurant in the South Hills. And we meet there, and it's been very enlightening. And back in my mind, I had put all of this back in the back of my mind, and I forgot a lot of it. And this, with men talking about their different experiences, and, well, yeah, I did that, and so-and-so. Another one reminds you of something else, and pretty soon you feel, well, yeah, I did something like that too. So it brings it to mind.
Let me ask you this, George. A lot of people talk about the World War II generation and the way that they dealt with PTSD, which really wasn't even a term that was used back then. The term that more often than not came up was shell shock. Is talking about it today, is it therapeutic for you? Is it something that still helps you to deal with the trauma that you went through?
I don't remember too many World War II people having, I mean, they came back and they hunted for their jobs and they went back to work and did what they could do. More so than some of the people in later conflicts like the Korean War and the Vietnam War, I think those in the later wars had a more difficult time than we did in World War II, because World War II, it was a war that was brought to us, and we went out and fought it. In the Korean War and the Vietnam War, they were brought in by drafting and so that kind of thing. Where a lot of guys didn't want to do anything like that, and they were forced into it, and I could understand that. With myself, I enlisted. I never thought anything about it. I enlisted, I went in, I did what I had to do, and I was proud of the fact that we were able to, my group on my small little ship, were able to do something to bring us out of a terrible conflict.
Does it help to talk about these kinds of things as you're talking to me about it now?
Now, yes, as I think about them. Years ago, it would pretty much devastate me, and I probably would never have been able to talk to you about it. Like with burying people at sea, that still is a horrible thing in my mind, but it kind of chokes me up at times also. The war that I was in was supposed to be the war to end all wars, and I'm hoping seriously that it never happens, but if something came today, it would, guys would mop things up, but this would be a war of the worlds, so to speak, and it would be a nuclear war, and I would never ever want to see anything like that, because it would end up like Nagasaki and Hiroshima, because all of these countries would really suffer greatly over it. And I would never in the world hope that anything like that would come to be.
George Herwig, thank you, and here's to no more war.
Thank you very much for having me.
Coming up, we'll look at the great American vehicle invented for World War II, the Jeep. That's when Essential Pittsburgh continues from the Heinz History Center and the World War II exhibit on 90.5 WESA.